I just lay there taking in the scene, wondering who in the world he thought was coming through that door. Neither of us spoke. I studied Miles's face. The same eyes, same nose, same mouth, same velvety smooth skin and sculpted cheekbones. But those drugs, as they often did, had turned him into a stranger. He sat there so long that the sun went down and I nodded off. Hours later, I awakened to the sound of his slamming the front door. I guess, he decided, whomever he was waiting on was never showing up. Strange. Another knife incident ended differently. Miles was preparing to host a couple he knew from the business. Before their arrival, I stole away to the kitchen to prepare hors d'oeuvres. At some point, he came in there and said something salty to me. I cannot recall what. Moments later, I picked up a serving tray holding our silverware, and as I carried it across the room, a knife toppled to the floor. Fire filled his eyes as he lunged toward me and punched me in my chest. "Oh, you have a temper, do you?" he shouted. I dropped the tray and folded my arms around my upper body. "What is the matter with you?" I squealed. He thought I'd thrown down the knife in anger as a response to his comment, and he interpreted that as an act of defiance, a pushback on his authority. When I explained through tears that the knife had fallen by mistake, Miles pulled me into his arms and squeezed me. "I'm so sorry," he said. "Please forgive me, sis." I'd of course heard that Miles had laid his hands on Frances and Betty, his first two wives, but up to then, he hadn't raised his fist to me. That incident marked the first and last time Miles ever struck me. And then there were the women. Miles kept his extramarital exploits mostly out of my sight, yet they were never invisible to my third eye. I always knew when Miles was stepping out on our marriage, just as my mother had known of my dad's unfaithfulness. I didn't need to be in the room to sense that it was occurring. Occasionally, evidence of his infidelity presented itself under the noonday sun, like it had in our first years together when Betty had shown up at his door. Once, when I confronted Miles about his womanizing, he had the gumption to say to me, "I wish you'd go out and see somebody." If I lifted my skirt around town, Miles reasoned, he'd feel less guilty about his sexual adventures. I did not respond, not with words anyway. As irrefutable proof of his affairs mounted, I pulled away physically. And on the occasions when we were intimate, I insisted on his using protection. We both knew why. It is astonishing, even to me, that I did not walk away from Miles at that juncture. In one sense, I pitied him even more than I loved him. How can you be angry at a man so broken, so intent on destroying himself? In another sense, I scorned him, resented that he was doing to me exactly what my own father had done to my mom, that he was brazenly betraying our vows. I was reliving my mother's story, a plotline I realize now that I'd unwittingly set up. When Miles and I had reconnected after years apart, I knew exactly who this man was. He demonstrated that during our first time together, and it stood to reason that his behaviors would continue as they did, especially once he'd gotten off his crutches and back on his trumpet. Love, however, is often not born of logic. It is birthed by need. Our dysfunctional histories drew Miles and me powerfully toward one another in ways inexplicable to us. Rage attracts rage. And though my fury, at times, manifested as brooding hostility, in contrast to Miles's blazing inferno, our marriage, for both of us, was about coming to terms with the extraordinary ache of our early years, that impressionable time when life pressed its thumbprints into our flesh. Our union was God's spiritual assignment to us, an opportunity to treat severe wounds that had festered for decades. Neither of us knew how to complete that homework. And as far as I was concerned, my relationship with Miles was not a lesson to be heeded, but a mission to be accomplished. God had put me here to save this man's life, a task I intended to carry out. That is how I saw it then, and that is why I remained at his side for as long as I did. When Miles cheated, he resumed the cycle he'd set up during our first go-round. I knew when he'd either snorted drugs or hooked up with some woman, because as before, he'd come bounding home with diamonds, racks of clothes, and enough flowers to host a funeral, as if those items would somehow erase the damage he'd done to me emotionally and spiritually. Nothing whips anybody's tail like guilt. In place of gifts, I longed for him to respect the promises we'd made. On some evenings, when he came in late after being out in the clubs with women, he'd slip through the front door and tiptoe to our bathroom, wiping off the lipstick on his mouth and neck. He'd then shower, put on his bedclothes, and sidle up next to me in bed. I'd lie there saying to myself, "Does this man think I'm stupid? Doesn't he know I'm aware of his behavior?" As he pulled me toward him, I'd pretend to be asleep while fuming inwardly. The thread that began unspooling our union came just after a lovely spring had given way to summer's first heat. I'd traveled out west to work on a project, and Miles, who was preparing to go on tour, had stayed at the Upper East Side apartment in New York. Though Miles still had his Upper West Side brownstone, and I, of course, had my first apartment around the corner on 74th, we mostly lived between my place on Fifth Avenue and the Malibu Beach House. Just as I was settling in at the beach house, my maid, an elderly Jamaican woman by the name of Jean, called me. "You know, Ms. Tyson," Jean said, "this is really none of my business." My throat tightened. "What's none of your business?" I asked. Well, she stammered. "I mean, I just don't think what Miles is doing is proper." "Proper? What are you talking about?" "Well," she went on, "there's a lady who lives in your building. She's married and she has a son, but the minute you leave here to go out of town, she is in this apartment with Miles." I clutched the phone and pressed it into my ear. "What lady are you talking about?" I asked calmly, though Hades raged within me. She described someone I'd seen, a white woman with a thick mane of curls sprawled all over her head. I hadn't ever spoken to her, but her husband often smiled and nodded when he saw me. "Do you mean the woman with the bushy hair?" I pressed. "Yes," she said. "She comes up here to your place, and sometimes he goes down to hers." There was more. Every morning at around 10 o'clock, revealed Jean, Miles and this woman would meet up right in front of the building and head off for a brief stroll along Madison Avenue. They'd then circle back around to the building, which overlooked Central Park. My maid, the elevator operator, the doorman, all three had been whispering about the liaison, stunned that Miles would risk being seen with another woman in and around my apartment. I thanked my housekeeper, hung up the phone, and booked a flight back to New York. I planned to arrive at the building at 10 a.m., just as Miles would be exiting to meet this woman for their walk. He froze when he saw me. "What are you doing back already?" he asked, drawing me toward him for a hug. I grinned. "The project was postponed," I said breezily. He turned to go back into the building, but I said, "Come on, let's go for a walk. I feel like stretching my legs after the flight." I gave the doorman my bags, and Miles and I set out on the route he and the woman had apparently often taken, over to Madison Avenue and then back around onto Central Park East. When we returned 15 minutes later, there she stood, out in front of the building, I'm sure, looking for Miles and wondering why he hadn't met her. You should have seen her face when she spotted the two of us walking up. She and Miles glanced at one another, clearly not wanting me to recognize the exclamation points in their eyes as they exchanged looks. I acted as if I did not notice, just as I'd feigned ignorance all those times when Miles slid into bed after wiping off fresh lipstick. My performance should have earned me an Oscar. Miles looked at her, she looked away, and Miles and I strode right past her and into the building. Once upstairs in our apartment, I didn't say a word to Miles about what the maid had revealed. I hoped, perhaps foolishly in retrospect, that my unexpected return home would be enough to put their tryst on ice. It wasn't. Miles kept right on messing with this woman when I traveled, and the maid kept right on divulging the details. I was as crushed as I was flabbergasted. The two had the nerve to be hooking up in my bed, on my sheets, in an apartment that my decades of toil in this business had bought and paid for. And they didn't even have the decency or discretion to keep it hidden from my maid and the building's employees. My housekeeper had heard their grunts and screams from behind the bedroom door. After seething privately for a time, I broached the subject with Miles in a doozy of an argument that shook Fifth Avenue. He predictably denied the affair, claiming that he and this woman were merely professional acquaintances. The maid had misunderstood, he told me. According to Miles, this woman, an artist and sculptor, had been teaching him to paint. Months earlier, Miles had been doodling all over the place. When I'd noticed him sketching directly onto our furniture, I'd gone down to Lee's art shop on 57th Street near Carnegie Hall and bought him paper and tools. Apparently, he'd turned to this woman for some tutoring. And yet, based on the claw marks I noticed on Miles's back and stomach, she was teaching him a lot more than how to wield a paintbrush. During the fracas, I threatened to divorce Miles, and he pleaded for me to stay. Then, in typical fashion, over the next few days, he presented me with a diamond brooch and another mink coat. Not long after my brawl with Miles, I spotted the bushy-haired woman as I was entering the building. She was sitting on a couch in the lobby, dressed as if she were about to go out for a jog. She looked me in the eye, pursed her lips, and smiled. "What are you smiling at me for?" I snapped. She sat back on the bench and exhaled. "Oh, I'm just being nice," she said. "People smile." Let me tell you something about myself. If this white woman hadn't dared to grin in my direction, I likely would have stepped right on past her and gone up quietly in the elevator. I'd done exactly that several times before then. But the fact that she had the audacity not only to look me in my black face and smile, but also to answer flippantly, disturbed me beyond measure. "Please don't do that," I said to myself. "Please stop acting like I don't know you're sleeping with my husband." I stepped toward her, and though she didn't push me, She raised her leg as if she were going to. Well, honey, she should not have done that, because the next thing I knew, that woman was on the ground. I'm not entirely sure how she got there. Trauma has a way of clouding one's memory. But on the other side of my momentary blackout, I do recall that both the doorman and the building manager whisked me into the elevator. Miss Tyson, come with us, the doorman urged. With that woman still sprawled out on the ground, they escorted me up to my apartment where Miles awaited. Before I'd had a chance to light into Miles, the doorbell rang. Miles stayed in the bedroom as I flung open the door. There stood the woman's husband, his face the color of cotton. He was dressed in a suit, as if he'd been on his way to work. "Hello, Ms. Tyson," he said. "I'm so sorry to disturb you. My wife said the two of you had a little problem." I glared at him through eyes wide as dinner plates. "A problem?" I said. "No, sir, I don't have a problem. Your wife is the one with the problem. You tell her that I said she is to stay out of my apartment." He loosened his tie, dropped his eyes to the floor, and then looked back at me. "She tells me they're working on an art project together," he went on. "I think there's been a misunderstanding." My laugh cut him short. "Yes, they're working on something all right," I smirked. "And I'm glad that you know that they are." That was my way of revealing to him that despite whatever his wife had told him, she and Miles had fallen into bed. I straightened my spine and stared at him without flinching. "Now, I'm going to say this one more time," I said slowly, emphasizing every syllable. "Please tell your wife to stay out of my apartment." Before he could respond, I closed the door. Over the next hour, brimstone spewed between Miles and me. Skillets were thrown. Insults were hurled. Empty apologies fell to the ground. The pathos and passion, the cataclysmic energy that fueled both our artistic endeavors, set our living room ablaze. Gone was my instinct to simmer in silence, as I'd done during my first years with Miles. In place of that impulse arose a fury, towering and untamable, unleashed with the velocity with which my mom had often cursed the husband who'd so deeply wounded her. Our conflict curtailed the affair for a time, but did not end it. The disgrace, however, did relocate across town to Miles's brownstone, or else to the woman's apartment when her husband was at work. Our thriller in Manila in the building lobby had scared both her and Miles away from my four walls. My maid, who cleaned all of our residences, dutifully continued her field reports, once telling me of the day when this woman had left a stoned Miles just outside of the front door of my apartment, several floors above hers. She apparently didn't want to put him on the elevator in such a state, so she'd led him up the stairwell. She then rang the bell and left him for my maid, who dragged him to the shower and rained water over his head to hasten his return to sobriety. Human behavior is a mystery, one riddled with contradiction. I don't excuse Miles's conduct any more than I dismiss my willingness, consciously or unknowingly, to indulge it. We mortals breathe incongruity. That I chose to stay with Miles is still, in many ways, confounding to me. And yet I've come to realize that Miles's behavior felt sorely familiar, a song, blaring and dissonant, that I'd learned in my early years. Some part of my spirit recognized that discord, had memorized the haunting notes of its refrain. My father had taught me the music, and my mother, in her own way, had emphasized each measure, hummed along with the clamor, even as she railed against it. "Men will be men," she'd sometimes mutter, following a feud with my father, her way of rationalizing his adultery. In a hovel at 219 East 102nd Street, I'd absorbed every nuance of that song, its words hovering beneath the floorboards and floating along the ceilings. Willie would be Willie, at turns tender and abrasive, and at tremendous cost to those he loved. And in my Upper East Side high-rise, a world away from the slum of my girlhood and yet overlapping with it, Miles would be Miles. The question became just how long I'd let the tune repeat. As my marriage stretched apart at the seams, Black Democrats rallied around the Reverend Jesse Jackson, the first African-American to run a nationwide primary campaign in pursuit of the presidency. Jesse set his political table on the legacies of Channing E. Phillips, the civil rights leader who in 1968 made history as the first Black nominated for the presidency by a major political party. Charlene Mitchell, the first African-American woman to run for the nation's highest office, which she did in 1968 as a third-party candidate. And, of course, the formidable Shirley Chisholm, whose place in the 1972 presidential campaign widened the public's imagination of how power can look and sound. Jesse had been with Dr. King when a bullet ricocheting across a motel balcony had killed the dreamer and threatened to snuff out the dream. Then, a young soldier of the movement, Jesse eventually emerged as the keeper of Dr. King's flame, as well as the founder of the social justice organizations Operation Push and the National Rainbow Coalition. Like no other candidate of color before him, Jesse's campaign galvanized the Black community as we glimpsed for the first time a viable candidate for the Oval Office. Reverend Jackson ran twice, in 1984 and 1988, and his first campaign coincided with my heyday as an actress. This was my era. Sounder and Jane Pittman had introduced me to the masses, while King, Roots, and A Woman Called Moses had deepened the connection. The scores of roles that followed, those I played, as well as those I wouldn't touch because they chipped away at our dignity, reinforced my stance as a race warrior. Throughout the late 70s and 80s, my phone rang off the hook with requests for me to speak here or appear there. On the eve of the 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco, Reverend Jackson came a-callin'. "Miss Tyson," he said with a smile in his voice, "would you be kind enough to speak at this year's convention?" I laughed as a shot of nervousness surged through me. "Absolutely," I heard myself telling Jesse. "It would be my honor." I was asked to reenact Sojourner Truth's electrifying "Ain't I a Woman" speech, which she delivered with nary a flinch or stutter at the Ohio Women's Rights Convention in 1851. When Sojourner marched to that podium, few might have guessed that she, an escaped slave who could neither read nor write, would ignite a cultural revolution. For that matter, only the father could have known that I, once a quiet and lanky girl with my thumb parked on my tongue, would channel Sojourner's fierceness on a stage before millions. God is the master of the unlikely. By the time Jesse requested that I speak, we already knew each other. Sometime in the late 1970s, I'd connected with his wife Jacqueline, and the two of us became close. I dined with her and Jesse on several occasions. So when Jackie heard that one of my films would bring me through Chicago to shoot, she graciously invited me to stay in her family's home during my weeks of filming. The year was 1983. Jesse hadn't yet announced his presidential bid, but he was gearing up. The public Jesse, the one I'd marveled at from afar, commanded a room with his soaring rhetoric. The private Jesse, the one I came to know, was by contrast markedly reserved. On many evenings, Jesse, Jacqueline, and their children gathered around the dinner table. I often joined them. While the group of us laughed and recounted the happenings of the day, Jesse listened intently, but said little. When he did speak, there wasn't a hint of flamboyance in his voice and manner. Perhaps he was saving his charisma for the spotlight he'd soon inhabit. On November 3rd, weeks after I'd departed Chicago, Reverend Jesse Jackson, then 42 years old, declared his quest to unseat President Ronald Reagan. The following year, as I arrived at the convention, my hands got to trembling. They trembled even more when backstage, Jesse's team ushered me around like I was a queen. I rarely get nervous before taking a stage, but this was no ordinary event. I'd never even attended a political convention, much less spoken at one. And judging by the way my poor heart palpitated, it frightened me. I whispered a prayer before walking out to the roar of spectators, hundreds of them waving banners for Reverend Jackson and Walter Mondale and Gary Hart. Upon taking the podium, dressed head to toe in white as my nod to the suffragists, I paused, overcome by the notion that I was standing there. My palms felt as cold as clay. I'll tell you, boy, Sojourner's spirit carried me through that speech. I drew in a breath, squared my shoulders the way she must have, and imagined the bravery she'd had to summon. Calling on her courage, I began. Well, children, I said into the microphone, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that betwixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, these white men gonna be in a fix pretty soon. The stadium erupted into whoops and shouts, which gave me a moment to further compose myself. But what's all this here talking about? I went on. That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Thunderous applause ascended to the rafters while I, exhaling with every refrain, gave myself over to the experience. Nerves have a way of disappearing when you think less about your performance and more about your purpose in speaking. By the end, I'd moved from reticent to rapturous, lifting my arms each time I repeated, "And ain't I a woman?" What a fire Sojourner had lit, and what a privilege it was for me, the daughter of her legacy, to stoke the blaze. Jesse, of course, did not become the nominee that year. Former Vice President Walter Mondale claimed the challenge of taking on Reagan, who ultimately triumphed in securing his second term. But Reverend Jackson, in both his 1984 bid and the one to follow, had made his statement. He'd also made space, just as Sojourner once had. Reverend Jackson's candidacy cleared the path that Barack Obama then just 23 and fresh out of Columbia University, would one day navigate. Jesse's campaign came bearing additional treasures, one for me personally. Backstage at the convention, I met a young lady by the name of Mignon Moore, who was then on Reverend Jackson's team. She'd been the one to arrange my appearance, and in so doing, the two of us struck up a friendship that extends to this day. Following her work on Jesse's campaign, the brilliant Mignon went on to become a political powerhouse, overseeing the Democratic Party as chief executive officer of the Democratic National Committee, advising the campaigns of Michael Dukakis, both Clintons, and a long list of other Democratic luminaries, and serving as a principal political advisor to President Bill Clinton and then First Lady Hillary Clinton. She's part of that tribe of mighty sisters known as the Colored Girls, five unstoppable truth-tellers who answered the call to political service: Donna Brazile, Yolanda Caraway, Tina Flournoy, Leah Daughtry, and my dear Mignon. I see and celebrate each of you. During the years when Mignon worked in the Clinton administration, she'd invite me to various White House events, including the elaborate 1994 state dinner for Nelson Mandela, then president of South Africa, and the man who pushed apartheid down onto its knees. Not long after Mandela's release from prison in 1990, I'd met him and the vibrant Winnie in South Africa. I'd even stood in the 8x7-foot concrete cell at Robben Island, where Nelson spent 18 of his 27 years in captivity. That was an experience and a half. On the day of my visit, an iron bed sat in a corner of the cell. That was never there while Mr. Mandela was imprisoned, the guard told me. Nelson slept on the hard floor for all his years in prison. There, during long nights down on that unforgiving pavement, Nelson secretly hand-wrote the first drafts of what would become his internationally acclaimed 1994 autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. What a testament to the resilience of the human spirit. Before the state dinner, Mignon welcomed me to stay with her. And child, why did she do that? Because now, decades later, she cannot get me out of there. Her home has become my haven away from New York. Anytime I'm in the area or just in the mood, I show up at her doorstep, pull off my wig stocking cap, and settle into the upstairs bedroom she keeps ready for me. What a beautiful human being, that Mignon, so full of warmth and exuberance. I cherish that woman. And I don't have to lift a fingernail when I'm at her place. Sometimes I sleep. Other times, my daughter comes with me, and the three of us just sit around, cackling over Love and Hip Hop, Atlanta, with me trying to keep up with all the young folks' lingo. Occasionally, one of my old films will pop up on Turner Classic Movies, TCM. That's my cue to leave the room. "No, you're going to sit right here and see this," Mignon always teases. It was on Mignon's couch that I, for the first time, sat through the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman from start to finish. I've never gotten used to seeing myself on screen. I hope I never do. A few years after I first met Mignon, another blessing flowed my way. In the fall of 1987, Pope John Paul II visited the United States with a stop at the Registry Hotel in Los Angeles. I, along with dozens of other artists and leaders, was invited. My seat was on the aisle along the right side of the large hall. When the pontiff entered, silence blanketed the room as all eyes turned toward him. Then, just as I was shifting my focus to the front of the hall to see what was happening there, I felt a hand on my head. It was his. I froze, not sure what he would do next. He didn't utter a sound as others around us looked on, probably wondering what was happening. He just stood there, with his warm palm cradled over my skull. Finally, after a long moment, he lifted his hand, met my eyes, and then made his way to the front of the hall. On his slow walk to the podium, he did not touch another soul. He delivered his remarks, none of which I can recall. All I could think of was that day, decades ago in Nevis, when a white dove had landed on my young mother's head. She'd been marked. She'd been consecrated. She'd been anointed and appointed to make the journey to America. I do not understand why the Pope singled me out. But God did. He knew that, like my mother before me, I'd need God's favor for the thorny terrain ahead. 21. Lesson before dying. Miles carried on constantly about white folks. "These motherfuckers don't even see me," he'd often say. "And when they do, all they see is a nigger." Racism, as it does, sat down on Miles's spine during his boyhood, and over decades, its sheer enormity and weight cracked his back. He'd absorbed the injury, endured the indignities that come with being a brother, the more black, the more invisible. But once your spine has been broken, you can never quite straighten it again. You navigate the world with a hunch and a limp. Miles's spirit, hobbled and fractured in a million places, bore such injuries. Miles didn't even want to live among whites, or so he claimed. When I first bought my apartment along Fifth Avenue on the East Side, a stretch known more for its pretension than for its diversity, I didn't even tell him about it until 2 years after I had purchased it, mostly because I did not want to hear his rants, and also because I craved a respite away from his escapades. "Why would you want to move over there with all those white folks?" he predictably said when I finally mentioned the apartment. The Upper West Side, where we'd lived, while not exactly Atlanta, was more integrated. Then one day, a few months later, when we were speeding up Fifth Avenue, he looked over at me and grinned. "Don't you have an apartment over here someplace?" he asked. I nodded, which marked the end of my safe haven. Soon after, Miles brought his antsy rump over there. Lord, that man could never sit still. He barreled restlessly toward the next experience, the next high, both in music and in life. The impulses that made him a genius innovator perhaps also fueled his promiscuity. Miles hadn't been in my East Side apartment but 5 minutes before he'd hooked up with the bushy-haired married woman I eventually taught a lesson. For someone who supposedly couldn't stand whites, Miles sure kept a rotating cast of them in his bed. The woman in my building was one. There were many others, women he carried on with when he was on tour in Europe. Word of his liaison with a young French woman, of course, got back to me, because with Miles, the secret never stayed that way for long. His body language, his guilty behavior, always told on him, and when his gestures weren't speaking, my sixth sense was. During those years, I had traveled to Africa on a tour with the United Nations, and when I returned, Miles surprised me with a Rolls Royce, a sure sign that he was still skirt chasing. Sure enough, a few weeks later, the woman he'd been seeing in Paris started calling day and night, demanding that he return there to visit her. He didn't go, nor did he succeed in hiding from me the whispered phone calls. I heard it all, even as I delivered my finest performance in pretending I was plumb deaf. Miles and I had spoken our promises in 1981, and by 1985, I knew the marriage was over. One day, I spotted a cluster of small red bumps just above his right lip. "What is that?" I asked him. "I don't know," he said, shrugging. "It's just a rash." He eventually admitted it was herpes, which I knew nothing about. I looked it up and then called my physician. "Be careful," the doctor warned me, explaining that the sexually transmitted disease had no cure. "You must always use protection." I'd already been doing so for years by then, but at that juncture, I altogether ended our physical intimacy, a lagging indication of our emotional distance. Still, Miles would often reach for me in the middle of the night, with scratch marks all over his stomach and groin after having carried on with his various women. I did not reach back. Jesus clearly lives in my back bedroom. It is only because he hovered so close by that Miles never passed herpes or any other disease onto me. The final unraveling of our vows came not long after the Pope had cupped his hand over my head. Miles's insistence on sleeping with a woman right under my nose became too much for me. There'd always been women, of course, as far back as when Miles had been fooling with Betty the first time we were together. The difference at this point was that she lived in my building. I spotted her often, prancing her tail in and out of the front door like she owned Fifth Avenue. I'd somehow been able to tolerate the stench of Miles's philandering from afar, but up close, its intense odor choked me. And the fact that she was a white woman, one 25 years younger than Miles, made the smell of the adultery all the more pungent. I knew I had to escape, and one afternoon in late 1987, an exit door appeared. Miles was in our bedroom getting dressed to go out and meet with some business colleagues, he'd told me. He stared in the mirror at himself, primping over that hair of his, or at least someone's. His own hairline had been receding for years, and Miles, then in his early 60s, had taken to getting weaves. He'd spend hours having his hairdresser, Finney, install them, and he insisted that every strand be in place. That hair meant the world to him. Just as he left the bedroom and rounded his way into the living room, a piece of paper fell from his pocket. He didn't notice it. When he went back into the bedroom, I reached down and picked it up. It was a note from the woman in my building. In it, she asked Miles to meet her at such and such address at such and such time that evening. I folded the paper in half, slid it under the lamp, and sat down on the sofa to gather myself. Moments later, Miles rounded the corner back into the living room. "Sis, did you happen to see a paper I dropped?" he asked. I stared at him without blinking. "I have that business meeting tonight," he went on, "and the folks I'm supposed to meet wrote down their address for me. I can't find it." I remained mute. "Sis, if you've seen it," Miles continued, his voice rising by the syllable, "I really need it." I finally shook my head from left to right. "No," I said. "I haven't seen any note." "Are you sure?" he pressed. "I mean, I think it fell on the floor over here and I need to have it." I stood up from the couch. "Miles Davis, don't bother me tonight," I snapped. "I don't have any note, and if I did have it, I would be foolish to give it to you." That's what started the tussle. "Give me the damn note," he shouted, lunging toward me. I backed up. "I'm not giving you anything," I sneered. "Why don't you go out and meet your woman? You know where to meet her. Y'all been meeting up all of this time, haven't you? Why do you suddenly need an address? If you want to go out and have the woman, then go out and have the woman. That's your choice. But please do not treat me like I'm too dumb to know what's happening. I charged into the bedroom, put on my shoes and coat, and reached for my pocketbook, intending to step outside and wedge some air between us. When I opened the front door, Miles grabbed my wrist. "Where do you think you're going?" he yelled. I wrenched my wrist free and put my hand back on the knob. "That's none of your business," I spat. "You've got your date. I've got mine." He reached for me again, and this time I snatched him by the back of his hair weave. "Don't touch me," I shouted. Well, honey, he got to twisting and turning, and the more he tugged his head back and forth, trying to pry himself loose, the tighter I held on. By the time he struggled free, I was holding a whole bushel of his weave in my right hand. I hurled it onto the ground, marched out the door, and slammed it shut. I'm not sure whether Miles met up with the woman that evening, but I suspect that he didn't. Vanity likely kept him indoors, because let me tell you, that man was preoccupied with his appearance in every regard. No way would he allow himself to be spotted around town with a big bald spot in the back of his head. By the time I returned home after a long, tearful walk up Fifth Avenue, those five tracks of weave were still strewn on the floor. Miles was sitting in the kitchen, waiting to kick up more dust. He stood from his chair when I entered. "You pulled out my hair," he shouted. I gazed at him as a mischievous grin spread over my face. "Oh, I did," is all I said. Although what I wanted to shout was, "Well, you can go out and buy yourself some more." Neither of us said anything else about the incident or the state of our relationship. I felt no need to drape words on the hanger of inevitability. The marriage had long since been over. That was obvious. All that had to be sorted was when we'd make it official. A few days following Weavegate, Miles told some journalist that I'd pulled out his hair, while he, of course, left out the details of what stirred the skirmish. He sought sympathy. He wanted the world to know that this woman, this Cicely Tyson that some perhaps deemed an innocent lady, had attacked him. What nonsense. Because if Miles hadn't tried to block me in that doorway, I never would have touched a strand of his precious locks. By grabbing my wrist and then by writhing himself all around, he'd pulled out his own hair, just like he'd unspooled the final fibers of our vows. And also, he should have kept his mouth shut. Why would you go around telling folks you've got a plug in your head, prompting them to try and spot it? At one point, I heard Miles saying to someone on the phone, "Do you know how much I paid for that weave?" And she just snatched it right off of my head. I didn't know whether to laugh or to cringe, which is why I did both. At the start of 1988, a month or so after our literal tug of war, I still hadn't fully left Miles. That changed on one morning when, as I was entering the kitchen at Miles's brownstone to blend up my greens, he said something snarky to me. I don't remember what devilishness tumbled off his tongue, and frankly, I don't care to recall. Without a word, I made my way upstairs, picked up my pocketbook, went out to Miles's gilt gift of a Rolls Royce, and drove to a friend's place. I never returned to Miles's home. That same year, I filed for divorce. Miles, who'd foolishly convinced himself that nothing he could do would wrench me from his side, reeled upon receiving the papers, or so I heard from his friend Finney. Miles eventually rang me. "Sis, I need to see you," he said with more rasp in his voice than usual. "Can you meet me?" I reluctantly agreed, though I refused to have him at my place. We met instead in a dimly lit cafe in a private booth at the rear. Miles leaned in over the table and spoke softly. "Sis, I don't want a divorce," he whispered. My gaze dropped to the table and then traveled back up to his hollow expression. "I want us to stay together, but just no sex," he said. I sat all the way back in the booth, the brute force of his words striking me in my chest. In the months since I'd last seen Miles, I'd heard the talk of his health status. Word at the salon was that he'd contracted HIV. In fact, though the U.S. press hadn't broadcast that news widely, it was all over Europe that he'd sought treatment there. He'd apparently begun a course of AZT, the antiretroviral drug then used to treat HIV and AIDS. Rumors also swirled that Miles and his longtime male hairdresser, Finney, were lovers. Frankly, I'd heard that gossip for years and had tuned it out for just as many. In hindsight, because believing it would have crushed me beyond repair. Denial became my iron shield, the breastplate I kept securely over my heart. As Miles sat there across from me, with sunken eyes and a skeletal frame, I didn't quite know what to believe. Two things, however, were certain. First, if Miles was asking for us to be together, minus all physical intimacy, and as I see it, a union without lovemaking does not a marriage make, he must have believed he was infected with something lethal. And second, he clearly respected me enough to protect me from whatever that was. I stared at him as I squelched tears, though one escaped down my cheek. Before the floodgates could swing open, I stood, retrieved my pocketbook, and walked swiftly from the restaurant without a word. That was the last time I ever saw Miles Davis. Barbara Warren, a friend so close to me that folks thought we were sisters, happened to know the transcriber who was working on Miles's autobiography. For months before our final meeting, Miles had been relaying his life story on tape, speaking in glowing terms about how I'd resurrected him to life, how I'd nursed him back onto his horn and kept him from annihilating himself. "According to Miles," said the transcriber to Barbara, "I was the greatest woman who'd ever walked across the planet, a towering beacon of compassion and warmth." Well, honey, the day after I met with Miles in that cafe, I became Cruella de Vil. He apparently tore up his initial transcripts and dramatically altered his characterization of me. It pained him that I would not reverse the divorce process, that I'd refused the pitiful pact he'd extended. He absolutely did not think I'd ever leave him. The truth is, years before I ended our vows, he'd long since given up on both our union and himself. The divorce papers simply formalized his betrayal. When Miles's book was published in 1989, I never read it, though I heard that, unsurprisingly, he had some not-so-pleasant words to say about me. Miles was clearly concerned about how I'd react to what we both knew were lies, because the second that volume hit bookstores, he started calling my friend Barbara, who also knew him well. For weeks, he rang her morning, noon, and night, leaving messages asking whether I'd read the book. He even called me. I did not answer, nor did Barbara. I had said everything I needed to say since that day in 1965, when I'd first spotted him on a bench in Riverside Park. 23 years is plenty long enough to clear one's throat and speak. Soon after the memoir's publication, Miles's daughter Cheryl came backstage to see me following one of my performances. "Have you read Father's book?" she asked. "Why would I do that?" I said. "I didn't need to read a book to know what was true. I lived it. And no written account could fully capture what I know happened between the two of us. And I know this. I loved Miles. And he loved me. At age 96, I still have many questions about this life. But of that fact, I am certain. In the same imperfect way that my father and mother cared for one another, in the same lopsided manner in which hostility and devotion can live side by side, Miles and I found deep connection, however flawed our union was. The final declaration of Miles's care for me came in the shadows of a cafe neither of us had ever frequented, in a conversation he'd never dreamed we'd have. "I want us to stay together, but just no sex," his gravelly voice had whispered. And though his words had pierced me on that evening, they also strangely became my salve in the following years. When all was said and done in our marriage, Miles thought enough of me to shield me from the malevolent forces that had taken him under. I think now that it wasn't Miles who'd protected me. Rather, it was the Savior, by way of a pontiff's warm palm, who kept me safe in his care. In 1991, Quincy Jones, a dear, longtime friend to both Miles and me, told me that Miles was near the end. "I didn't know he was so sick," Quincy repeated over the phone, his voice quivering. "I just didn't know." Miles's vital organs were wrecked, just as they'd been in the months before I took him to Dr. Shun. His children and his nephew Vince, along with other close family members, were eventually called to his bedside in Santa Monica. Though I was in California at the time, I had no desire to see Miles in that state, emaciated and struggling for oxygen. That would have tortured me. Barbara went to visit. Just as she was leaving, he motioned for her to draw near him. She leaned down close so she could hear him over the hum of the breathing machines. "Tell Cicely I'm sorry," he whispered through labored breaths. "Tell her I'm very, very sorry." Days later, in the fall of 1991, Miles slipped from this life and into the next. On the day the world lost Miles, I was at the beauty parlor in New York. While seated in the lobby, waiting for my appointment, a bulletin came over the radio. "We interrupt this broadcast with the news that jazz legend Miles Davis has passed away at St. John's Hospital near his home in Santa Monica. He was 65. In silence, I got up and walked out of the salon, which was near my Upper East Side apartment. Just as I was crossing Madison Avenue, I somehow found myself flat out in the middle of the street. I had not tripped or missed a step, and yet there I was, down on the gravel, with my heart galloping away. I quickly gathered myself and stumbled to my feet, shaken by what might have been if a car had sped through there. "Oh no, Miles Davis, I'm not going with you," I thought as I stood. "I wanted you in life, not in death. You chose to leave this place, but I'm not going anywhere." I believed then, as I do now, that Miles aimed to take me with him. And yet 3 decades later, I am, by God's mercy, still right here. While mourning the last act between Miles and me, I poured myself into work. In 1988, the year I filed for divorce, I had met Oprah Winfrey. The premiere of Oprah's national talk show 2 years earlier in 1986 had irrevocably altered television's landscape. The shift came literally overnight. The microphone-wielding Phil Donahue had created the template for talk television, moving hot topics from the couch to the studio stage. Who can forget how Phil raced around his set, eliciting input from his audience while intermittently shouting, "Caller, are you there?" to those who phoned in. His show, syndicated nationally in 1970, had established a seemingly immovable foothold in the ratings. Well, darling, God had another foot in mind, a brown one. Enter Oprah Winfrey, Mississippi-born and spirit-led, who took Phil's blueprint and made it sing soprano. From her very first episode, Oprah bested Donahue in the ratings, welcoming her viewers to a shoes-off, Kleenex-required, purpose-filled conversation that ultimately revolutionized the culture. She grabbed the number one spot in the ratings and held on to it for 25 seasons. The year Oprah and I first connected, her production company, Harpo, had begun filming The Women of Brewster Place, an ABC miniseries based on the National Book Award-winning novel by Gloria Naylor. The story showcases the nuanced experiences of seven black women in a dilapidated tenement. Oprah, who played Maddie Michael, the main character, had gathered an ensemble cast of other gifted actors, including Lynn Whitfield, Jack Kay, Robin Givens, Mary Alice, and Olivia Cole. She asked me to portray Mrs. Brown, the dignified, well-to-do mother of Melanie, Robin Givens' character. Having read the book, which few could do without weeping, I wholeheartedly said yes. It makes me smile now, given the global force for good that Oprah has become. But her body language told me she was a little nervous the first time she saw me on set. By then, she'd delivered a pair of hanky-lifting performances in The Color Purple and Native Son. Yet alongside an old-timer like me, she was then a relative neophyte of the stage. When I noticed her slight fidgeting, I chuckled to myself thinking, I'm the one who ought to be intimidated. Like her daily talk show, the award-winning Brewster resonated with viewers, and it eventually even led to a weekly series. Though I played in the original series, I of course did not view it at the time. 2 decades later, I happened to catch it one evening on BET, and mesmerized by the plotline, I cried from start to finish. I called Oprah afterward. Boy, that Women of Brewster Place was something, I exclaimed. What a fabulous piece of work. The phone line went silent for a moment. You mean you've never seen it? She asked in disbelief. No, I told her. But I finally caught the rerun. Oh, Cicely, she said, cracking up. What can I tell you? 20 years late is still better than never. My work with Oprah on Brewster was just the start of what has become a cherished sisterhood. For her 50th birthday in 2004, I knitted Oprah a special gift, a tapestry rug, with no idea how my creation would spawn one more priceless. Upon receiving my present, Oprah thanked me, while inwardly chiding herself that she'd forgotten to invite me to her birthday luncheon that year. That gave her the idea to ask me over for our own tête-à-tête, a thought that soon prompted another. Why not invite Ruby Dee as well? Next thing Oprah knew, her inkling had flourished into the Legends Weekend, a grand 3-day celebration of 25 African-American women whose legacies have served as a bridge from past to present. She also invited 45 youngins, those with the privilege of navigating that overpass. In May 2005, we all gathered at the breathtaking Montecito estate Oprah aptly calls the Promised Land. My heart just about burst open with joy that weekend as I reveled in the company of longtime friends, including Diane Carroll, Ruby Dee, Coretta Scott King, Maya Angelou, and renowned Essence editor-in-chief, Susan L. Taylor, while soaking in the tributes of the youngins who, in unison, read to us the Pearl Clegg poem, We Speak Your Names. That Sunday morning on Oprah's lawn, at a gospel brunch like none I've ever attended, B.B. Winans handed the mic to Shirley Caesar, First Lady of Gospel, and the Holy Ghost showed up and cut a step. throughout the weekend, Gail King and Stedman Graham, Oprah's two mightiest oaks, teased me. "This is all your fault," they kept saying, laughing as they recounted how my gift had given birth to the grandmama of soirees. For Oprah's 60th a decade later, I moved on from knitwork and sent an enormous bouquet of roses with stems nearly as tall as she is. That blew her away, so much so that she posted a photo on Twitter. "I've never seen roses that tall," she told me. Not too long ago, I ran into her and Stedman, Oprah's rock of nearly four decades, her gentle giant. "I tell you, boy, that man must be 7 feet tall." "What do you do?" Stedman said when he saw me, sweeping me up in his wide arms, baffled that I never seemed to age. "It's all about the greens, my dear. Thrice daily, blended if you prefer, taken with a side of temerity. That, along with bar pull-ups in my apartment and walks all over Manhattan, keeps my body strong. My bar is right in the doorway of my master bedroom. Soon as I get up in the morning, I do 3 sets of 20 pull-ups. As for preserving my mind, continuing to take roles well into my 90s has been my sustaining force. Folks retire so they can sit on the couch and watch television while they wait to die. I've known several people, 6 months after they stopped working, so did their hearts. Some form of occupation is necessary for survival. For years you get up, get dressed, eat breakfast, and work all day. It's an exercise. What makes you think you can suddenly cease that routine without slipping into senility? You can't just stop, or that'll be the end of you. I aim to live. Purpose courses through my veins just as surely as artistry does. It's what gets me out of bed, eager to do my pull-ups, and curious to discover the world anew. Following the airing of Oprah's Brewster in 1989, other roles came my way, though still never with the same frequency with which they flowed for my white contemporaries. But you take what you can get, and sometimes what you can get is a delightful character like Sipsy in the 1991 classic Fried Green Tomatoes. Sipsy, a family cook dressed in a head wrap and an apron, lacks in glamour what she makes up for in guts. Still, some of my mother's old friends, those who'd been murmuring since the day I showed up on screen in Sounder donning a do-rag, piped up with their chorus of complaints. Asked one, "Why are you always looking like a ton of lodging?" The West Indian expression for a ragamuffin. "I don't write the roles, sweetheart. I simply authenticate them. And why on earth would a home cook be made up in lipstick and heels?" Anyway, I loved that Sipsy because she was ballsy. In the film, Sipsy stirs up some trouble for a certain wife beater, and that maverick act leads to her best line: "The secret's in the sauce." To this day, when folks come up to me and utter that phrase, I know they've reveled in Sipsy's chutzpah as much as I do. Madam Queen, another audacious character I portrayed in the 1997 crime drama Hoodlum, had twice Sipsy's moxie. "You talking about feisty, boy. That woman was something. A gangster through and through. She brought the numbers racket to Harlem. Oh, how I loved playing her." The mid-90s, for me, is a misty watercolored blur of films that could put me fast to sleep right now, save for my star turn